And
this talk will go approximately 50 minutes. I tried to cut it. Maybe I can get it to 48. But as Betty Davis said, hang on, it's going to be a bumpy ride. And I want to start with three quotes. This is from Charles Adams, a book called For Good and Evil, The Impact of Taxes on the Course of Civilization. It takes great leadership and ability to settle differences through peaceful means. Any idiot can start a war. From Randolph Bourne in The Nation, in the magazine The Nation in 1918, war is the health of the state. And from that famous foreign policy analyst, Will Rogers, quote, "Now you can't pick up a paper without reading where the Marines have landed to keep some nations from shooting each other, and if necessary, we shoot them to keep them from shooting each other. 7,000 miles is a long way to go to shoot somebody, especially if you're not right sure they need shooting, and you're not sure whether you're shooting the right side or not." The 20th century was truly the century of total war. Between 11 million and 16 million soldiers and civilians were killed in World War I. My great aunt Ruby, born in the 1890s, called it the Great War, the term given it before people knew there'd be a World War II. I come from Canada, which lost many people, especially young ones, during that first war, and in virtually every little town in English-speaking Canada, even the towns I grew up in, both of which had a population of under 2,000, you can find a monument, usually near the town hall, honoring the Canadian dead of that war. That war also led to the famous poem In Flanders Fields, written on a battlefield in Belgium by a Canadian named John McCrae, who died later in the war. It is recited all over Canada every November 11th, which in Canada is called Remembrance Day, a term I much prefer to Veterans Day. I will never forget the haunting and powerful ending, which I first heard in second grade when my fellow student Nancy Kelly read it to the class. "To you from failing hands we throw the torch, be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we will not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields." One of the main things I want to address is how not to break faith with those who died. I think it's by not purposely having more deaths. World War I was Trump... Okay, I can handle applause lines. World War I was trumped by World War II, in which at least 60 million people and probably more than 70 million people died as a direct result of the war. To put that in perspective, if the same percent of our population died in war today, that would be 190 million people. World War II always seemed more real to me than World War I because I was born in 1950 and grew up hearing relatively fresh stories from the adults in my community and especially from my father. My father joined Canada's army in 1942. It was a volunteer army even during the war, at age 32, but was kicked out days after winning his stripe because from age 17 on, he had only about 20% hearing in each ear. He had told the recruiter this upon voluntarily joining, but it took a few months for the army to hear him. My Uncle Fred and Aunt Jamie were civilians early in the war, making their way to the Belgian Congo to be medical missionaries. Unfortunately, the ship they were on, the Zam Zam, was sunk by the German Navy. Almost miraculously, given that by the German captain's count, 6 out of his 55 shells had hit, only one of the passengers died as a result. My aunt was held prisoner in Berlin until June 42, and my uncle was a prisoner in what is now Poland and later occupied France before he escaped to Switzerland. And one of my favorite kinds of movies, I admit, when I was growing up was war movies, although I also admit my favorite war movies were about escapes. So World War II was always in my consciousness, and I was always aware of its tremendous costs in lives. What I wasn't aware of was its full costs in liberties, some of which was permanent. When I was a senior economist with President Reagan's Council of Economic Advisors, my office was in an old, exotic-looking building called the old, now the Eisenhower, Executive Office Building. Mark Twain called it the ugliest building in America. Located right next to the White House, from which it is separated by a narrow driveway, it's the place most people actually work when they say they work in the White House, and I pulled that one too. A curious type, I looked into the history of the building and found that in its first years, in the late 19th century, it housed the War Department, the Navy Department, and the State Department, all in one building. That means that this building, together with the Treasury, is on the opposite side of the White House, but the same shape, had essentially the whole of the executive branch in of government, other than the Post Office and the Departments of Interior and Agriculture. What happened in between? that and my time, that led to such a massive growth of the federal government in a country that was justly celebrated as the land of the free. Or, as Steve McQueen's character in one of my favorite anti-war movies, The Sand Pebble, asks in the movie's last scene, what happened? What the hell happened? A large part of what happened was war. A huge amount of the new power that the government took on in the 20th century was power that it acquired during and due to war. When the wars ended, the power diminished, but never back to its pre-war level. Economic historian Robert Higgs was one of the first to point out this ratchet effect. We generally think of prohibition, for example, as beginning with the Volstead Act of 1920. Wrong. It began soon after America entered World War I with the Lever Act. The federal government had imposed price controls on agricultural products, including wheat, and gave itself preferential access to those products for the war efforts. Many kids hated spinach when they were growing up. I should have known that I'd be an economist because I hated price controls. The predictable effect of those controls was a shortage of wheat. With the anti-alcohol movement growing strong, the government rationed the wheat by refusing to allow any of it to be used in the production of alcohol. Imposing prohibition a few years later was that much easier because people had been softened up by partial prohibition during World War I. Other federal powers grew during World War I also. The federal government nationalized the railroads, and although it denationalized them after the war ended, it retained stricter controls on the railroads than had ever existed before the war. The military draft was introduced during the war. And it was when it was legally challenged, the Supreme Court did not seriously consider its opponents' claim that the draft contradicted the 13th Amendment stricture against involuntary servitude. I highly recommend reading their very short decision to see nine old men not doing a good job of reasoning. After World War I, the draft ended, but the precedent had been established, and a peacetime draft was again imposed during the late 1930s. After World War II, the draft was retained with a hiatus of only 1 year, 1947, and then kept until 1973. And finally, the income tax. It had started in 1913 as a small tax on only the super rich of the time. The top rate of 7%, which kicked in at $500,000 annual income, which is over $11 million in today's income, was raised to a whopping 77% in 1918. Even the bottom rate, which had been only 1% on incomes over $4,000 for a married couple, was raised to 6% on incomes over $2,000. Although spurred by Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon, Congress pushed through the major cuts in tax rates at all levels throughout the 1920s, the tax rates never came close to their pre-war level. What started as a small tax on only extremely high-income people was, even by the end of the 1920s, a substantial tax on the high-income people who were the next level down. Something similar happened in World War II. The federal government took on new powers to regulate wages and prices, and it was these powers that President Carter used in the late 70s to impose wage and price guidelines. Also, FDR increased tax rates during World War II, raising the bottom rate from 4.4% to 23%, and the top rate to 94%. To extract such large amounts of wealth from the American people, the government initiated an installment plan called withholding. The end of the war brought a very small tax cut, but we never got rid of withholding. It was far too tempting for the government to keep this source of perpetual funds. Federal government spending, which even with all of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal programs had not gone above 10% of GDP, hit a peak of over 40% during the war. It came down substantially after the war, but it was still at 14.2% before the Korean War. Also, they used a lot of the revenues, fortunately, to retire the government debt. But still, by 1974, when the debt-to-GDP ratio was at a post-war low, spending as a percent of GDP was 17.4%, almost twice the level it had reached by 1940, the last full peacetime year before America's official entry into World War II. Incidentally, I should have asked, can everyone hear me? Okay. Incidentally, one person on the left who recognized that war leads to more government control and celebrated that fact is editor of The Nation, Katrina Vandenhoevel. Less than 3 months after 9/11, Vandenhoevel and co-author Joel Rogers wrote, quote, "If anything, the war on terrorism creates an opening for progressives, not closure. Indeed, it represents the opportunity of a lifetime." It is a truism of modern politics that war generally mobilizes and helps the democratic left. It does so despite the repression of dissent that wartime also often brings, because war raises the stakes in politics and invites consideration of wider goals, including justice. War's mobilization of the populace against a shared threat also heightens social solidarity, while underscoring the need for government and other social institutions that transcend or replace the market. In other words, me summing up her, government grows in wartime, displacing free market institutions. She likes that, I don't. That government power grows during wars and fails to recede completely after wars means that the cost of war, usually reckoned as the amount spent on the war, the lives lost in the war, and the personal liberties lost during the war, has been systematically underestimated, or as George W. Bush would have said, misunderestimated. The true cost of fighting a given war must include not just those three components, but also the liberties lost and amount spent on government due to powers that the government never gives up after the war's end. That wars have higher costs than has commonly been thought is not, of course, enough of an argument against engaging in war. But the benefits to the United States of fighting wars in the 20th century are not as well established as is commonly believed, and that's where I want to go. In analyzing war, economists have been largely AWOL. One reason is that to do it well, you have to know a lot of history, and most economists are pretty ignorant of history. Economists, therefore, have accepted many of the myths that the public in general has accepted. But the economic way of thinking, as distinct from economists, has a lot to say about foreign policy. It's just they haven't been saying it. I've started to. Three themes from economics are particularly relevant to foreign policy: information problems, incentive problems, and unintended consequences. In the rest of my talk, I'll weave those themes together and apply them to U.S. foreign policy in the 20th and 21st centuries. One of the major contributions of economists like Ludwig von Mises, Friedrich Hayek, and Milton Friedman, and of the thousands of economists who have studied specific markets and specific government interventions, is to point out that when the government intervenes in people's economic lives, it often creates a worse situation than would have existed had the government done nothing. This happens for two reasons. The first, which was emphasized by von Mises in the 1920s and later refined by Hayek in the 30s and 40s, is that the government does not have and cannot have the information required to plan the economy. The information required cannot exist in a small number of even the most brilliant minds because it's in bits and pieces in all of our minds. Moreover, the mechanism that comes closest to capturing and summarizing that information is the price system, the free market. The second reason government causes problems, which was developed and emphasized by public choice scholars James Buchanan and Gordon Tullock in the 1960s, and has been extended since by economists who've studied various government agencies and bureaucracies, and understudied the DOD, by the way, is that the government officials do not have the right incentives. Government officials, whether politicians or bureaucrats, do not bear much of the cost of their bad decisions and do not get much of the gain from their good decisions. That same reasoning applies whether the government bureaucracies are involved in domestic policy or in foreign policy. Consider first the information problem. A big information problem is where to intervene and whom to support. One of the biggest problems with centralized economic planning, aka socialism, argued Hayek, is that virtually all the information that an economy needs to function is held by millions of economic actors. Hayek called this the knowledge of the particular circumstances of time and place. Hayek argued that little of this information can be known to a small number of people at the center. Thus, socialism would fail even if there were no incentive problem. Nothing in Hayek's argument suggests that it applies only to central planning of a domestic economy. A government that intervenes in another country's affairs faces the same problem. Indeed, the problem is worse, because the small number of government policymakers at the center have even less information about the foreign country than they have about their own country. The problem then becomes one of knowing which countries they should intervene in, and beyond that, even if they appear to have good grounds for intervening, how to intervene. David Friedman, the son of Milton Friedman, pointed out that when a fairly liberal government, like ours, wishes to intervene, it often must choose between two or more illiberal dictators. Writing in 1973, he gave a concrete example, quote, "In practice, an interventionist policy almost inevitably involves alliances with the Shah of Iran, or the present government of China, or Joseph Stalin, or Ferdinand Marcus, or in the case of actual policy of the United States over the past 45 years, all of the above." He went on to say, "In order for the interventionist policy to work, it is necessary to correctly figure out which countries are going to be your enemies and which your allies 10 years down the road. If you get it wrong, you find yourself unnecessarily blundering into other people's wars, spending your blood and treasure in their fights instead of theirs and yours. You may, to take an example not entirely at random, get into one war as a result of trying to defend China from Japan, World War II, spend the next 30 years trying to defend Japan and Korea and Vietnam from China, then finally discover that the Chinese are your natural allies against the Soviet Union." Former Wall Street Journal reporter Jonathan Quitney, writing in 1984, recounted how U.S. government officials made major decisions about foreign policy with little knowledge of the countries for which they were deciding, with disastrous consequences. Quitney tells, for example, how U.S. government officials in 1960 failed to understand that the Congo was a few hundred mini-nations whose people were trying daily to avoid starvation. Instead, the government officials interpreted everything with reference to their own Cold War with the Soviet Union. This lack of local knowledge extended even to cultural differences. C. Douglas Dillon, President Eisenhower's Undersecretary of State, judged the Congo's Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba to be, quote, "an irrational, almost psychotic personality," unquote. What was Dillon's evidence? It was that Lumumba, quote, "would never look you in the eye," unquote. Dillon did not know that many Africans are taught that avoiding eye contact is deferential. Because of these officials' negative assessments of Lumumba, President Eisenhower gave the CIA orders to have him murdered. He was actually murdered by someone else locally, but they knew they had the green light from the U.S. government. Clearly, knowledge of Lumumba's true character and personality was important, given the major decision based on that misinformation. I mentioned unintended consequences. Unintended consequences applies in spades to military action. Quitney, the person I mentioned who wrote the book in 1984, lists 15 lessons to be drawn from foreign policy. Lessons 4, 5, and 8 are directly relevant to the idea of unintended consequences. Lesson 4 is, forceful intervention by a big power in a third world country, no matter how well-intentioned, is almost always dramatically harmful to the people who live in the country being intervened in. Lesson 5 is, intervention by either major power, he had in mind the other one being the Soviet Union, regardless of what the other is doing, usually tends to be counterproductive for the intervener. And lesson 8 is, force creates enmity. If it creates respect as well, that is less enduring. The late Chalmers Johnson gave a label to the idea of unintended consequences in foreign policy, a label that, according to Johnson, was coined by the CIA, and that label is blowback. With most wars, one intervention that creates unintended bad consequences leads to another intervention intended to offset those consequences. How, for example, did one of the world's most monstrous dictators of the 1990s, Saddam Hussein, build his military machine in the 1980s? The answer is that the U.S. government helped him. By the way, it's a pet peeve of mine never to say we helped him. I had no role in it, and my guess is no one in this room did either. The United States government wanted an ally to offset the power of Iran's government during the ghastly Iran-Iraq war, and so it subsidized Saddam with billions of dollars of credits and provided Iraq with intelligence and advice, presumably on the mistaken assumption that, quote, "the enemy of my enemy is my friend." Saddam consolidated his power in Iraq and tried to take over Kuwait. Without the original U.S. aid to Saddam Hussein, he would have been less likely, not zero probability, but less likely to invade Kuwait. If so, the Gulf War and its aftermath, which killed only a few Americans but tens of thousands of innocent Iraqis, might have been avoided. Moreover, the fact that Iran was the enemy of the United States from 1979 to now was itself an unintended consequence of U.S. government intervention. In 1953, the CIA, with Operation Ajax, helped overthrow Iran's Prime Minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, after Mossadegh nationalized some British oil companies. Incidentally, although the CIA first finally admitted its 1953 role in 2013, I got former CIA Director James Woolsey to admit it 10 years earlier when he gave a talk at the Naval Postgraduate School. Operation Ajax led to the Shah of Iran taking power. Now, I do not defend a government that takes people's private property, but local governments in the United States often do that with eminent domain, something Donald Trump is familiar with, by the way. If a foreign company's assets were taken forcibly here, and a foreign government tried to overthrow the offending U.S. government, I think most of us would be pretty upset, even if we were against the original taking. The CIA also trained SEVAK, Iran's secret police, which tortured the Shah's political enemies. Funny how that pisses people off. In 1979, some Iranians sought vengeance by taking over the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. I do not defend that action either. Rather, I would like to avoid the U.S. government sticking its hands and our tax money and possibly safety in hornets' nests. Consider a case of huge unintended consequences, World War I and its aftermath. Kaiser William II of Germany could well have been one of those idiots whom Charles Adams referred to in the quote at the beginning of my talk. As one biographer put it, quote, "The last Kaiser's most pronounced and most fatal characteristic was his habitual inclination to act almost entirely on the basis of his personal feelings. One of his most consequential moves, made on the basis of vanity, was his building of a powerful German navy concentrated in the North Sea. Winston Churchill called the German navy a luxury fleet. It served no practical purpose but threatened Britain's dominance of the seas at a time when that was the exact wrong thing to do. Germany never had much desire to go to war with Britain, but building the navy communicated something a little different. That was a factor in leading to World War I. Woodrow Wilson, the U.S. president at the time, had vague ideas about making the world safe for democracy. But the connection between that goal and getting into a war allied with Russia, one of the most autocratic regimes in Europe, was never clear. Wilson did not have the information he needed to use military force to have the impact in the world that he claimed to want. His intervention set off an ugly chain of unintended consequences. The Treaty of Versailles ended World War I, but helped set up World War II. Early in the proceedings at Versailles, a young economist advising the British government quit in disgust when he realized that the terms imposed on the German government would be humiliating and punitive. He also pointed out that the terms contradicted the agreement that Wilson had made with the German government in late October and early November 1918, terms that the German government required before being willing to end the war. If you recall, Germany surrendered even though it had managed to prevent the war from reaching its soil. It was winning. This economist, who quickly denounced the treaty in his book, The Economic Consequences of the Peace, was John Maynard Keynes. In the first part of his passionate book, which was more psychology than economics, Keynes did a masterful job of explaining the interaction among three of the four major players: French Premier George Clemenceau, British Prime Minister David Lloyd George, and U.S. President Woodrow Wilson. Clemenceau, according to Keynes, dominated the proceedings, Lloyd George went along, and Wilson, probably in part because of his ill health at the time, didn't seem to have a clue. Clemenceau used his power to craft a vengeful treaty. Keynes also predicted that these measures would create resentment among Germans that would unsettle the fledgling German democracy. Keynes actually understated the threat from the angered German people. As an historian named Kagan puts it, quote, "The determination to undo the treaty that was the symbol of that dishonor was a central goal of almost every German statesman thereafter." The German political parties that accepted the treaty governed the newly formed Weimar Republic until 1933, and because most Germans saw the treaty as a betrayal, these parties never won the loyalty of the German people. Germany was ripe for someone who would once again make them feel proud of their country after having been beaten down for 15 years. And such a person came along who ruled with a viciousness that had not been seen in 20th century outside the Soviet Union. His name, of course, was Adolf Hitler. The harshness of the Versailles Treaty's terms and the fact that the terms contradicted Wilson's commitment to the German government made the treaty unaccepted by the German people from the outset. One can argue that the terms were not overly harsh, given the destruction that Germany had caused. But that destruction, once the war was over, was what we economists call a sunk cost. The new goal should have been to prevent it from happening again, and this the Allies did not do. Had it not been for the harshness of the Versailles Treaty, Adolf Hitler might not have come to power. In turn, had Clemenceau not sought vengeance on Germany, and had Wilson not been so ineffective, the treaty would have been less harsh. Which means that Clemenceau, by pursuing his own personal agenda, regardless of the costs imposed on millions of Europeans, French, German, British, and otherwise, helped cause World War II, in which over 60 million lives were lost. Clemenceau's actions caused huge problems, partly because he didn't understand what he was doing, and partly because he didn't seem to care about the consequences. He had the wrong incentives. Of course, Hitler did become the dictator of Germany and built an awesome military machine that he used to attack various countries in Europe and to murder millions of people. The lesson most people in the United States, Britain, and Canada take, the lesson I grew up with, was what might be called the lesson of Munich. The lesson of Munich is that the U.S. government and other democratic governments must vigilantly look for nasty dictators building military machines and must intervene to stop them before they get too powerful, because such a war of early intervention is much less destructive of lives and property than a full-blown war later. In 1938, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain went to Munich to appease Hitler by negotiating Czechoslovakia's territory, negotiating it away, in a region called the Sudetenland. Chamberlain did this without even allowing the Czech government to participate. In short, Chamberlain conducted a highly interventionist foreign policy. And what he got in return was Hitler's assurance that he would stop there and not carry out his conquest further. Of course, we all know that Hitler did not stop. World War I would have been easy to avoid, and the consequences probably would have been much better had the U.S. avoided it. But what about World War II, what Studs Terkel called the good war? By the way, I'm reminded of a great line from Benjamin Franklin. There's no such thing as a good war or a bad peace. If I can establish that the U.S. government would have maintained the freedom of its own citizens without going to war against Hitler, then the lesson of Munich crumbles. Could the United States have avoided war with Hitler? I think so. The United States has and have the good fortune of being protected from Europe's and Asia's most belligerent powers by two gigantic moats, the Atlantic and the Pacific. By the way, I gave a talk to 55 newly chosen admirals back in Maryland in 2010, and made that point, and they argued China's this danger, but what it came down to, China wants to control that area around them. They admitted it was no danger to us, just to our influence. In the 1940s, Hitler's chance of doing serious damage to the United States was close to zero. It is true that Hitler did declare war on the United States only 3 days after the U.S. government declared war in Japan, a move on Hitler's part that has to qualify as one of the larger strategic blunders of the 20th century foreign policy. But of course, he wouldn't have done that had the United States not declared war in Japan, and the United States would not have declared war in Japan had Japan's government not bombed Pearl Harbor. And now we need to take a step beyond what normally passes for discussion of how America got into the war. My wife and I left the Ben Affleck movie on Pearl Harbor a few years ago, and my wife is a pretty smart person, but she hasn't read a lot of history. She said, "How come they attacked us?" Well, hold on. Why did Japan's government bomb Pearl Harbor? Did Emperor Hirohito and General Tojo just wake up one morning and say, "That would be a good idea"? No. Rather, it was a response to steadily tightening restrictions that U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt had imposed on trade with Japan beginning in 1940. In July 1940, Roosevelt, wanting to pressure the Japanese government, which had invaded China, imposed an embargo on some grades of aviation gasoline and on iron and steel scrap. As Japan's imperialism escalated, so did FDR's measures. Finally, in July 1941, in response to Japan's troops occupying southern Indochina, FDR froze all Japanese assets in the United States and announced that all trade with Japan had to be licensed by the U.S. government. The New York Times said at the time that FDR's actions amounted to, quote, virtually severing trade ties with the empire. That was a big deal. FDR's and the Japanese government's intransigence put the two on a collision course. After fruitless negotiations, the Japanese government declared war shortly after attacking Pearl Harbor. But FDR badly wanted the United States to get into the European war. He had bent the Neutrality Act to give assistance to one side in that war, Britain. His so-called Lend-Lease program, which would have been more aptly named subsidized Britain and the Soviet Union, but that didn't quite have the same ring. Well before Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt had already given orders to U.S. Navy ships to shoot at German submarines on the eastern coast of the United States. Given his desire to get into the war, he was willing to chance a Japanese attack. Japan's government had imperial ambitions in Asia and was being thwarted by the U.S. government. In short, it would not have been difficult for the United States to avoid war with Germany or with Japan. Some of the strongest proponents of the need for war by the West against Hitler point to the fact that Hitler laid out his plans for foreign conquest in his tortured autobiography, Mein Kampf. In Mein Kampf, Hitler made clear that his goal was to conquer Russia. Hitler wrote, "And so we National Socialists consciously draw a line beneath the foreign policy of our pre-war period. We take up where we broke off 600 years ago. We stop the endless German movement to the south and west and turn our gaze toward land in the east. At long last, we break off the colonial and commercial policy of the pre-war period and shift to the soil policy of the future. If we speak of soil in Europe today, we can primarily have in mind only Russia and her vassal border states." Hitler's goal, as he always made clear, was Lebensraum, living space, in which his Aryan race could farm and thrive. A quick look at the map shows that the obvious place that had such space was not Western Europe, but Eastern Europe. Famed bank robber Willie Sutton said he robbed banks because that's where the money is. Hitler wanted Russia because that's where the Lebensraum was. Given that his goal was to take over Russia, he would likely have failed, or at least reached a stalemate, even without intervention by Britain and the United States. Russia was simply too vast, which created huge problems for the Germans in maintaining a supply line over a front that was 1,700 miles long. Also, Hitler needed to wrap up the operation quickly to avoid the harsh Russian winter, something he failed to do, which cost him dearly in the first winter after he invaded, the winter of 41-42. Finally, Hitler underestimated the tenacity of the Russian people in fighting for Mother Russia. It's true that if he hadn't made the strategic error of having his troops sit for 19 days, less than 200 miles from Moscow during the summer of 1941, he might have taken it over. And that later, if he'd not thrown away so many German lives taking Stalingrad, he would have been able to focus on the real prize. But every government makes mistakes, even evil ones. And to carry off a victory in Russia would have required that Hitler make virtually no major mistakes. In ESPN talk, he would have had to pitch a shutout. Moreover, even had Hitler succeeded in taking over Russia, it's hard to imagine a scenario in which he could hold on to it. He would have had to make Russia, with a population of well over 100 million people, most of them hostile, into essentially a garrison state, and would have had to use about 2 million German soldiers simply to hold on to Russia. That's based on the standard rule of thumb that when you're an occupier, you need 20 troops for every 1,000 people. Given the way Hitler treated conquered peoples, hauling Jews and Slavs off to death camps and others off to work camps, he would have likely needed all those soldiers every day. It's understandable that we in the West think of World War II as being about D-Day, the invasion of Normandy in June 1944. Our war movies are almost all about American war fighters. But the reality is that most of the war in Europe happened between Germany and Russia. By definition, the Eastern Front was for where virtually all Soviet lives were lost, and these losses were as many as, are you ready for this, 35 million. The number of German military lives lost on the Eastern Front was about 4 million versus only, I'll put that in quotation marks, 263,000 on the Western Front. To put it in another perspective, even on D-Day, when the Germans knew that an invasion from the West was imminent but just didn't know where, Normandy, 62% of German, that was a good line from The Longest Day, I guess it didn't work, 62% of German troops were on the Eastern Front fighting off the advancing Russians. Historians tend to agree that by the fall of 1943, almost a year before the West's invasion of Normandy, the Russians were beating the Germans. Now, you could argue, as Patton did, that U.S. and Britain really needed to be in the war to prevent the Russians from taking over even more of Europe than they did and make it into a garrison state. They clearly seem to have that goal. I think there's something to the argument. But notice that it illustrates my earlier point about one intervention leading to another. Why was Russia such a threat on the Eastern Front towards the end of the war? Part of the reason was Lend-Lease, the original intervention by Roosevelt to send over 400,000 trucks, 13,000 combat vehicles, 11,000 airplanes, and other war material to the Russian government. This not only helped the Russians push the Germans out of Russia, but also helped them take the war into Germany and take over in Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and East Germany. Moreover, because of the war with Britain and the United States on the Western Front, the Germans could not focus entirely on the Eastern Front. It's hard to look at those facts and not conclude that, had the West stayed out, the Russians and Germans would have fought to a standstill. It's even conceivable that Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and East Germany would have been free 40 years earlier than they ultimately were. By the way, I gave a talk up at the Hoover Institution a couple of years ago to 47 foreign Navy officers, and I pointed out to them that when I make this point, these points I just made, and I'm in the Hoover coffee room, and if there are 11 people there and I'm one of them, and we talk about World War II, it's 10 to 1. I'm always on the one end. But I held up this big book, and I said this book was written by a guy whom the Hoover Institution is named after, and some smartass in the back said, J. Edgar Hoover? And I said, no, Herbert Hoover. And I read them segments from it about Hoover was kind of live blogging, we would call it now, during the Second World War, and saying, don't do this, let them fight it out. But doesn't my reasoning ignore the fact that Hitler murdered a few million innocent Jews? No, it doesn't, for three reasons. First, World War II was not about Jews. There wasn't even a tiny part of the motive the British, the Americans had for fighting. If saving Jews had been part of the motive, this is where that noise comes, by the way. I'll try to speak a little louder. If saving Jews had been part of that motive, there was an easier way that involved not further government intervention, but less government intervention. The U.S. government could have relaxed immigration restrictions to allow in the hundreds of thousands of European Jews who were desperate to find a safe haven. You might argue that such a law couldn't be passed. But FDR didn't even try. Moreover, he refused to let a number of desperate Jews get off a German ship, the MS St. Louis, in 1939 and enter the United States, a ship that, given its hostile treatment from governments in North and South America, ultimately had to return its innocent occupants to Hitler's death trap. Second, judged solely by the number of Jews saved by the Allies' entry into the war, World War II was a catastrophic failure. Hitler succeeded in murdering well over half of the Jews in the territories he controlled. The Allies showed up only in time to free at most 130,000 prisoners from concentration camps, not all of them Jews, and tens of thousands of them died of disease or malnutrition shortly after. Third, and most important, isn't the reason we care about Jews that they were innocent victims of a bad man? That's certainly my reason. In that case, can we really justify an alliance with a man who was almost as bad, Joseph Stalin, and who killed millions of innocent people. The current count of people murdered by the Soviets is about 20 million, and Stalin was responsible for well over half of those murders. Now consider the Cold War. In discussing non-intervention in that context, we need to distinguish among three very different aspects of the Cold War, only the latter two of which involve an interventionist foreign policy, which is what I'm arguing against. The first was defense, specifically defending the United States from a Soviet attack, something I favored. Unfortunately, in an era in which both sides had thousands of nuclear weapons, defense involved threatening to attack the Soviets with all the horrible consequences that would have entailed if they had attacked us. Well, that is horrible. I don't regard such measures as inconsistent with a non-interventionist foreign policy. I'm not positive I would push the button if I were president, but that's a tough one. The second aspect of the Cold War involves spending substantial funds and putting Americans at risk by extending the nuclear umbrella to Europe. But even as the late Cold Warrior Robert Conquest, my former colleague at the Hoover Institution, admitted in 1978, the GNP of the Western European members of NATO greatly exceeded that of the whole Warsaw Pact, including the USSR. In other words, they could have defended themselves. The third aspect of the Cold War involved getting into wars and financing wars in other countries that the U.S. government saw as important in the contest with the Soviet Union. The U.S. government financed so many allies and carried on so many proxy wars during the Cold War that a complete case is impossible to make in my short time here. But consider one of the biggest wars that the U.S. government got in, the Vietnam War. Former President Dwight Eisenhower argued that Vietnam was a domino. If it fell to communism, other countries in the area would have fallen also. Even if that had been true, it is difficult to see how falling dominoes in a region thousands of miles across the Pacific could have threatened the liberty and safety of Americans. But the case against the Vietnam War is easier to make, and the person who made it best briefly was one of the main people who carried it out. Former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. Who here has seen the movie The Fog of War? All right, I'm going to quote from it. In that movie, he tells of a meeting he had with Nguyen Co Thach, foreign minister of Vietnam, and during the Vietnam War, an aide to Lee Duc Tho at the Paris peace talks in the late 1960s. This now is McNamara talking. The former foreign minister of Vietnam, a wonderful man named Thach, said, quote, "You're totally wrong. We were fighting for our independence. You are fighting to enslave us." And McNamara says, "We almost came to blows. That was noon on the first day." And then Thach says, "Do you mean to say it was not a tragedy for you when you lost 3,400,000 Vietnamese killed, which in our population base is the equivalent of 27 million Americans? What did you accomplish? You didn't get any more than we were willing to give you at the beginning of the war. You could have had the whole damn thing, independence, unification." And now here's McNamara saying, quoting Thach, "Mr. McNamara, you must have never read a history book. If you'd had, you'd know we weren't pawns of the Chinese or the Russians. McNamara, didn't you know that? Don't you understand we've been fighting the Chinese for 1,000 years? We were fighting for our independence, and we would fight to the last man, and we were determined to do so, and no amount of bombing, no amount of U.S. pressure would have ever stopped us." My reading of history says that this was the norm, that what the U.S. government saw as a contest with the Soviets was typically not that unless the U.S. government made it one. Various people in previously colonial countries wanted independence and were opportunistic in dealing with the Soviets. Whitney, who I quoted earlier, writes, "The excuse for intervention is the notion that if we don't fight, Moscow will win by default. Yet as one travels the globe, from Indochina to Cuba to Angola, one finds that the third world countries where the Soviets are alleged to have the strongest influence are precisely those countries where we have fought. Meanwhile, in countries that weren't militarily threatened by the United States, where Soviet influence has had a chance to flunk on its own merits, it has. In Egypt, in Ghana, in Algeria, in Somalia, in Nigeria, in Indonesia, except in occupied countries along the Soviet's own border, the Russians have been kicked out." What about terrorism? The basic case against intervening in other countries to fight terrorism is threefold. First, terrorism is a tiny threat. Second, intervening in other countries is a way to make it into a little bigger threat. And third, fighting terrorism the way the U.S. government has reduces our freedom at home. Ohio State University political scientist John Mueller notes that since the late 1960s, which is when the U.S. State Department began counting, and now I'm going to quote, the number of Americans killed by international terrorism is about the same number as the number killed over the same period by, are you ready, lightning, accident-causing deer, or severe allergic reaction to peanuts. And that's an or, not an and. In other words, it's not a large threat. However, there is a way to make it larger, although still probably small, which is what the government is doing, and that is intervene with force in other countries. In December 1996, I spoke to a group of Defense Department officials. My speech was a comment on a paper by my Hoover colleague, Henry Rowan, a former president of the RAND Corporation. I pointed out that in his paper, Rowan had taken terrorism as a given, but that one should step back and ask why terrorism exists. I said, quote, what leads the Irish Republican Army to put bombs in Britain? Why don't they, for example, put bombs in Canada or Bangladesh? To ask the question is to answer it. They place the bomb where they think it will help influence the government that makes decisions most directly in the way of their goals, and the governments in the way of their goals are usually governments that intervene in their affairs. Then I concluded, quote, if you want to avoid acts of terrorism carried out against people in your country, avoid getting involved in the affairs of other countries. One person in the audience, noted game theorist, economist at Yale University, Martin Shubik, sarcastically accused me of advocating that, quote, we all love one another, unquote. He missed the point, and I pointed this out at the time. A good game theorist puts himself in the shoes of the other person, whether or not he loves him. Even if you hate your opponent, and especially if he hates you, it's good to know what motivates him. Interestingly, the Department of Defense the next year, its own Defense Science Board, wrote, historical data show a strong correlation between U.S. involvement in international situations and an increase in terrorist attacks against the United States. The surest way to reduce the terrorist threat to close to zero is to quit intervening in other countries' affairs so that potential terrorists no longer have a grudge and or motive for terrorizing the United States. By the way, one thing, a good idea to do is when these people... I've forgotten the guy's name in the Times Square bombing when he got to make his statement before he was sentenced. Read what he says. Read how he's saying, I don't like you guys messing with my country. The editors of National Review, the conservative magazine, in defense of America's interventionist foreign policy, have argued that refraining from intervening to reduce the risk of terrorism would be, quote, preemptively capitulating to the terrorists, unquote. Possibly. But if so, then people who refuse to walk alone in New York Central Park at 1 a.m. are preemptively capitulating to muggers. The analogy is not perfect, but the imperfection strengthens my point rather than weakening it. If I walk in Central Park alone at night, I put myself at risk. But if U.S. makers of foreign policy intervene in the Middle East and elsewhere, they put all of us at risk. Finally, the third argument against the war on terror is the way the United States has done it has substantially reduced our liberty, especially our freedom to travel by airline without government permission, and a permission, moreover, that we get only by submitting to a very intrusive examination or photo or x-ray of our bodies. I got to tell you, when I moved here in 1972 from Canada, if you had told me that normal Americans would just go through those lines and meekly take off their belts and their shoes and let someone feel them up or take x-rays of them, I would have said, you're crazy. I will end with this. No one speech can make the complete case for a non-interventionist foreign policy. The range of issues to be covered, the small but important facts in history, and the various counterfactuals to be considered would take at least a book and probably a few books. But in this short time, I've applied some basic economic thinking that economists have used to argue against most government intervention in the domestic economy. This basic economic thinking, along with some knowledge of history, makes a powerful case for a non-interventionist foreign policy. Thank you, and I guess we have some time for question and answers. Yes?
I have more than once heard the comment, I have to explain this a little bit.
Okay.
That if we had a draft, Congress would be less willing to fund the military, the president would be less willing to have an aggressive foreign policy. People generally would not vote for either a president or legislators who support intervention overseas. Would you care to comment on that?
I've actually written an article on that. When I first heard that argument, I didn't like it, but it seemed, I didn't like it because I don't like a draft, but I always let my likes be separate from my analysis, and it made some sense to me. But as I got thinking about it, I concluded it doesn't make sense, and that's what I wrote up. The argument, I'll just fill in the reasoning, I think this is what you're getting at, that the rich and powerful would have their kids at risk, and then they pay more attention to foreign policy, and they get the government to be a lot more careful. Here's the problem. The rich and powerful want their kid out of it. If we have a draft, they won't focus on creating what economists call a public good, lobbying to have this whole war prevented, and they can have, each individual can have minimal effect on that. They're going to lobby to get their kid out of the draft. And if they fail to get their kid out of the draft, they're going to lobby for their kid to have a safe place to go when drafted, say Alaska or Germany or whatever. And so I do not think it holds up. Exhibit A for people who make that case is the Vietnam War. In my article with my co-author, our Exhibit A is the Vietnam War. Look how long we had the draft before, and look how many Americans were killed before there was a real anti-war movement.
That makes a relation in 72,
so. Sorry?
I said, well, to reinforce your point, Nixon won re-election in 1972.
That's right.
How strong could the anti-war movement have been at the time?
Yeah, good point. Yes, sir?
Having been a child during World War II, I was always interested in what prompted the rise of Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
And my own personal feeling is that Adolf Hitler was a brilliant con artist. And what he did, you have to digress to that period of time, the early 1930s, where the laissez-faire capitalism pretty much went bankrupt. There were worldwide depressions throughout the world. And a lot of the rich industrialists were concerned. They saw what happened in Russia with this revolution and the rise of the Soviet Union and the confiscation of their wealth.
Right.
And in the United States, we had some rich, powerful people that were sympathetic to Hitler before the outbreak of war.
Mm-hmm.
Henry Ford, John D. Rockefeller, Joseph Kennedy, they were sympathetic to Hitler because they felt that Hitler would crush Russia and eliminate the threat of Bolshevism.
Right.
He double-crossed them. He used that as a ploy to gain their support and rise into power, and then he double-crossed.
Okay. I just want to make sure we spread it, so I'm going to stop you there and respond to that and then go to someone else.
Yeah, okay.
It is absolutely the case from my reading of history that a lot of rich people in Germany supported Hitler, not because they liked him, they also feared him, but they feared the communists more. And they thought he would suppress them, and of course that didn't work out. What I just want to point out is two things, one about there and one about the economics, which I'm quite familiar with. One thing that's understated that people don't get was how much of a youth movement Nazism was. It was an incredible youth movement. And so the real people pushing it were people younger than almost everyone in this room, except maybe you. And so I just want to point that out. The United States and the other countries did not have a laissez-faire system. They actually had a fairly regulated economy, and this would take us too far afield. But the government, I've written on this, and other people have written on this, the U.S. government essentially caused the Great Depression with the way they controlled the money supply, with the Federal Reserve completely messing up. And then Hoover made it worse, and Roosevelt made it worse. But that would take us too far afield. Yes, Tom.
I'd like to pick up on his point. There's a more general point that basically there are corporations in the background that are pulling the strings and causing politicians to go to war. And I noticed that your analysis didn't include that. Even beyond the military-industrial complex, which is a common theory, but you know, even the oil companies or McDonald's or whomever, that the corporations are really behind them.
Well, no, I don't think it's true. I think the military-industrial complex, certainly. So you look at Lockheed Martin, you look at those kinds of places, huge incentive to have war. McDonald's doesn't have an incentive to have war. War takes wealth. War destroys wealth, as a poster you once held at an anti-war rally said. And so taxes are higher when there's war, or if they're not higher, they're not cut where they would have been cut. So no, corporations generally don't gain from war. It's the war. It's the corporations directly involved. In fact, it's very hard to find any evidence that McDonald's ever lobbied for war, or that you know Coca-Cola did or whatever.
What industries were the guys who supported Hitler in?
I don't know. It was more. I was looking at the fact there was more wealthy people wherever they got their wealth. Tim.
One of them was a CEO of Procter & Gamble, and they actually were responsible for working with IG Farben for the production of Zyklon B, which was used in gas chambers. So I think there is some, but I don't know that it really applies to them. Look at Apple, the most profitable company in the world.
Yeah.
It might be the first company to reach $1 trillion. Well, where the hell do they get all their rare earth metals from? They get it from China. So no, they have absolutely no incentive to see us go to
Yeah, and I cannot show this, but let me just tell a story from first couple of months of the George W. Bush administration. Do you remember when the U.S. Navy plane was forced down by the Chinese in about March of 2001, and there was that real crisis for a few days, like what'll happen, there were all these tensions, and then it got resolved. And here's what I think happened, although I cannot prove it. I bet you the head of Walmart and a few other places that buy a huge amount of stuff from China went to George Bush and said, don't mess this up. We got this great trade going on. Trade, by the way, creates peace. Trade makes peace more likely. There was a famous quote from a not famous person named Otto Mallory, a State Department diplomat, who said, when goods don't cross borders, armies will. And so trade protectionism tends to create enmity. Look at India and Pakistan. Look at the tremendous tensions they had over the years on their border. Look at the fact that trade between India and Pakistan has just multiplied, and it's become much less likely they'll go to war. Yes?
Are there any parallels at all between Germany and the rise of Hitler in general and what we see in our country and the rise of Trump?
Well, yeah, just in the sense that Hitler was highly nationalistic, and I think Trump is probably the most nationalistic candidate we've had in recent years. Like, he doesn't understand the basic economics of trade. He thinks China, like he says, we're not winning. Well, every time you buy something from China, you're winning or you wouldn't buy it. You know, so yeah, I think there's that nationalism. I don't think it's close, but I'm not sure. Sir?
History repeats itself first as tragedy, second time as farce.
Uh-huh.
That's your answer.
Although I think someone said, it might have been Mark Twain. Mark Twain said everything, right?
No,
I know. This next one I'm going to give you. History may not repeat itself, but it does rhyme.
It stutters.
What?
It stutters.
It stutters? That's a good one. I like that. Did you make that up?
No, I read it. It may have been funny.
Yeah. I know I wanted... you mentioned about the draft, and you kind of gave me credit that I don't deserve. I did in 19... So here's the story. The draft was eliminated in 1973. I was 22. I had just moved to the United States, so you can hardly attribute any role to me. But there was a serious push in the late 1970s to bring back the draft, and here's why. We had high inflation, and the government had frozen the wages paid to first-term enlistees. So their pay relative to inflation was really lagging, and they were having trouble meeting their goals and their quality goals. And Senator Sam Nunn, Democratic senator from Georgia, started pushing for the draft. And I went and testified against it. I was now, at that point, 28. But I started really tracking the draft, following it, and there was a serious push to bring it back. Ronald Reagan was very anti-draft. And a friend of mine, Doug Bondo, who was one of Reagan's first 9 people involved in his campaign, was very anti-draft, as was Marty Anderson, his boss, who was from Hoover. And Bondo and Anderson made sure they had in his draft acceptance, in his nomination acceptance speech he gave at the convention in Detroit, a strong statement not only against the draft, but in favor of a commitment to get rid of draft registration, which Carter had reintroduced. So once Reagan got elected, I know politicians tend not to keep their promises. And so at that fall, before he got elected, I put an anti-draft statement together and got a whole bunch of economists to sign it, including, by the way, Alan Greenspan. And we got an ad in a couple of there was the Progressive magazine out of Wisconsin, a couple of other magazines with our statement with over 100 names. So that's my little role in it.
I just mentioned something.
You may.
When it brought a thought to mind, when I was drafted,
yeah,
did my basic training at Fort Ord,
yeah,
many, many years ago.
What year?
Had an indoctrination.
What year?
1960.
Okay. Yeah.
30 years ago. They had an indoctrination session for us new recruits, and what they told us was that war is an extension, I still remember it, I never forget it, war is an extension of diplomatic relations onto the battlefield.
Sounds like Clausewitz, right?
War
is politics by other means. I think it's true. It's true. But by the way, I would rather have diplomacy. So my guy in the Republican, and I'll get to you, sir, I promise, you're next. My guy in the Republican field was Rand Paul, who said basically it never hurts to talk. You know, talk is better than fight. And he got shot down for that. Sir?
Bernie Sanders and Ed Schultz are suggesting that America needs tariffs again, and how would this look at the economic picture, tariffs?
So tariffs get in the way of trade. Tariff is a tax on trade, so you'll have less trade. Trade is beneficial to both sides, so those tariffs would make us poorer. Way poorer? No, because we're not a small country, we're a big country, so we can produce most things anyway, but it'll just be higher cost production. If you get Donald Trump-level tariffs, 45%, and put them on everything, we would probably be, and I'm just making this up roughly, we'd probably be about 1 or 2% poorer.
Does a tariff help with a trade deficit?
Not typically, because, see, a tariff means we buy fewer of their things, so they have less money to buy our things, so not only do our imports fall, our exports fall. So there's no necessary connection between raising a tariff and reducing the trade deficit. I'll get to you, sir. The best way to reduce a trade deficit is to have a bad recession. If you look historically, when we have recessions, we cut imports way more than our exports fall, and I don't think we want that. Sir?
As an economist, you probably endorse the principle of comparative advantage.
Yes.
Comparative advantage translates into saying that everything should be produced where labor is cheapest.
No, where production is cheapest.
But that is the same thing.
No, it's not. Because you look at cost not just by looking at wages, but looking at labor productivity. And some of those countries where wages are really low, productivity is really low too. Sir?
Things like NAFTA and TPP are sometimes called free trade agreements. Is that a good name for them?
No. NAFTA is closer to one than TPP. Let me just say bit by bit. NAFTA did reduce a lot of tariffs and a lot of restrictions on trade. So it was a move toward free trade. But as Milton Friedman said at the time, 1993, why do you need, if you're going to have free trade, why do you need 2,000 pages? Right? And so you could have just said, which I support and many economists support, unilateral free trade. Whatever the Mexicans do, whatever those crazy Canadians do, let them do it. We're going to cut all of our restrictions on their imports, and we would have made out as well or better. TPP does cut some tariffs, but it also involves a lot of other things on intellectual property. And I think in this country, we've gone way too far on intellectual property. I don't know if you followed in the 1990s when Disney persuaded Congress to extend intellectual property by something like 20 years. So Mickey Mouse was about to become someone, you know, not protected, and they added 20 years. So now it's like 95 years of protection on intellectual property, which I think is way too extreme. And my fear is that they will harmonize upward, and that, in other words, most of the other countries will be caused by TPP to have much too lengthy intellectual property times, and that concerns me. So I think it's a one hand on the other hand thing. My guess is the net gain to the United States is positive, but I'm not sure of that. Sir?
I'm not sure you're aware that Mark Twain lobbied for years to have copyrights extended. He wanted them perpetual.
Yeah.
He said that intellectual property is just like real estate or any other kind of property.
Yeah. I was not aware of that.
Disappear after a set period of time.
Yeah.
So your favorite writer, your source of quotations, is actually your adversary.
That's fair. I mean, basically, my view is with anyone, you take the wheat and reject the chaff. Tim.
I'm just going to say that, though. I don't think that intellectual property, as we've sort of traditionally defined it, is whether we moral or immoral doesn't even answer into the question. Like, technology is just progressing to such a point that we can't enforce it the way we did. It's totally and completely impractical.
Yeah, as one economist put it, let's say you were first designing intellectual property laws in 2016 with everything you know about the web. Would you make them like they had them? Probably not. It's very hard. I'm starting to think, by the way, that Apple's taken over my iTunes, but I'm not sure of that.
Are we good?
Is there anything, now this is really very general, is there anything in the American psyche that causes our particular current thing in the world, and by that I mean this thing in the American psyche that high emphasis on the individual. I mean, we're the only country that doesn't have medical care. And that, I think, is a result of our outlook on the world. In other words, you shop around, you do things, we don't want the government. And my question has always been, why not the government? We have the government dictating our laws, how we drive our cars out here, mm-hmm. how we do a million other things, but there are certain pieces that I just shake my head and have no answer to, and Bernie Sanders is addressing some of those, I think. But okay. It's just an amazing, what is it about us that causes this?
First of all, it's not true about medical care. Almost everyone has medical care, and almost everyone had it before Obamacare. What is not true is that everyone had health insurance, and those are two separate things. If you look at the data on individuals who lacked health insurance, you know who paid half of their bills? They did. So I just don't think it's true that we lack medical care. But it is true that there's more of a kind of a pro-freedom spirit here than in most other countries. That's part of why I moved here, because I knew they were about to get rid of the draft. So that was the big negative here. And so I think that pro-freedom spirit is a part of it, but I do see it. I'm not going to satisfy you because we're on opposite sides of this, but I'm trying to explain. I do see that really going away. In other words, I see people just taking it when government tells them do something, do it. So you've got vaping, for example, that is actually keeping lots of kids from smoking cigarettes. And what's the FDA say? We're going to regulate vaping. And you, if you want to introduce a vape, you've got to spend $1 million to show it's safe. And a lot of small companies are going to be put out of business, and there'll be big companies that'll charge higher prices, and there'll be more people turning to the traditional things like cigarettes. So I see this incredibly intrusive government going after us in so many ways. And so I think we've lost the individualist spirit. As I said, in 1972, if a TSA person had tried that out of nowhere, I think someone would have punched him, and rightly so. And that won't happen now. Tim.
How about one more question, and then we'll end it.
Okay. Short one. Nuclear weapons. Had Werner Heisenberg actually completed his work by 1943, like he had promised, to develop a nuclear weapon for Hitler, does that change your calculus in your mind?
Yes, but let me say how. It doesn't mean, because remember, we're deciding, or not me, FDR is deciding in 1941 whether to go to war with Hitler. So in this scenario, you know they'll have weapons in 43, or you don't know?
I guess it's a good question.
So you don't know, you don't go to war. You find out he has weapons, you then start paying attention. And by the way, I mean, Hitler, I'm not defending Hitler, I think you can tell from my speech, but Hitler reached out to Britain because he didn't want a war with Britain. He wanted, as I mentioned, to go east. So I don't think, you know, nuclear weapons would have been even a threat against Britain if the British hadn't gone to war with them. And I think they wouldn't have been a threat against us if we hadn't gone to war with them. Follow up on that?
Sort of kind of in that same general area of history. So in referencing discrimination against the Jews in America when they're trying to escape Germany, why did you pass up a very obvious opportunity to take a swat at the American Medical Association and their requirement for American citizenship to be a doctor?
Limited time. So let me say something about that. It is true. A number of Jews came over in the early 30s, and the AMA, with its lobbying for the restrictions on, you know, who could be a doctor, prevented a lot of them from being doctors. By the way, we still see that. Every once in a while, I'm in a cab, not an Uber, maybe I'll be in an Uber, but in the old days, meaning 4 years ago, in New York, in a cab, and I'll get the guy who's driving me being a doctor from Pakistan or something. And that's tragic, because he could have huge value added, he could be better off, we would be better off, and I would like to get rid of all those restrictions. I would like for, you know, if you want certification, you have the government certify the person. And if he doesn't have the certification on the wall, he doesn't have it on the wall, and you choose. And I bet a lot of those people could give you shots, could give you all kinds of things without having that certification, and medical care would be much cheaper.
Let's hold an additional question until afterward, and thank David for
okay.
a remarkable...
Thank you. Thank you.